Anybody want to move the approval of minutes?
So moved.
Adoption of the minutes has been moved. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We've adopted the minutes. And John Walls, why don't you, we're going to hear from the Department of Human Services, and most of that is in our budget this year, but John, why don't you just point out what we're not having. You passed out, you have a sheet in your packet that they'll talk about.
Mr. Chair, John Walls, post-fiscal analysis. Members, in your packets, there's another one-pager. It looks like this. The title is Minnesota Department of Human Services. There's not much to explain there except for all the program areas within Human Services are bolded, and the activities within those programs are the non-bolded. You'll see there are certain programs that are highlighted. The MFIT child care, the basic sliding fee child care, and child care development are activities within Human Services that the funding is going to
Mr.
go
Chair?
To.
Yeah, Representative.
I don't believe we have this handout.
Looks like this. Okay. Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, those three child care programs are in the Early Childhood Committee. You'll also see refugee services grants and other children and economic assistance grants go through the Housing and Health Committee. All these other activities that you'll see in the non-bolded type fall within the bolded programs. You'll see a listing of the governor's recommendation from all fund sources. This includes direct and statutory appropriations. And you'll see their general fund bases in the column to the far right, which in most cases is half or less due to the heavy use of federal funds or health care access. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that if you use this sheet, and on the back are the two activities that we have in the Department of Health. Representative Abler had requested a list of our accounts and the activities on both sides, with the exception of the bolded programs in the other committees, are the extent of the accounts in this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Walls. Any questions? Okay, now we're going to hear from the Department of Human Services. We have Commissioner Cal Ludeman here, who a year ago at this time was Commissioner of Dewar. And I told the Commissioner one time that he went from the best job in state government to the toughest job in state government. So welcome to the committee, Mr. Commissioner.
Thank you. Representative Huntley, Chairman Huntley, I really appreciate that. And I want to say I express my appreciation to the members of this committee also, not only for the invitation, but for all the work you were about to do in looking at the budget of even one agency like this agency. You will find the numbers of hours of work and the dedication of the certain performance on these numbers and what they mean not only to the taxpayers but the clients that we serve are extremely important to this state, and I appreciate the work that you will be doing.
Could you just introduce your name and title for the table?
I am Cal Ludeman. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Human Services for the state of Minnesota. Yes, quite a bit different department than the Department of Employee Relations, which I'm understood to believe not to exist at some point in the future. I also appreciate this opportunity, Mr. Chairman, to introduce Governor Pawlenty's budget recommendations for human services. I will provide a brief overview today, not the whole thing, and I will turn it over to our Chief Financial Officer, Jane Wilcox Hardwick, and Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson for discussion. You will also be hearing from Deputy Commissioner Christine Bronson and the rest of our assistant commissioners about other areas of our budget in the coming weeks. The governor's proposed budget for the 2008-2009 biennium makes significant investments in human services while maximizing value. This budget furthers our mission to help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. To accomplish this, the governor proposes expenditures of $22.2 billion. $9.3 billion of that is from the state's general fund. $12.9 billion of that is from other funds. As I mentioned during the agency overview, which many of the EU members participated in, most DHS general fund spending, about 88% of it, is on health care and health care-related programs. This includes the purchase or coverage of basic health care and long-term care. It also includes direct care provided by DHS for people who have a mental illness, chemical dependency, developmental disability, acquired brain injury, or pose a risk to public safety. The budget proposals for human services represents a 14.4% increase from 2006 to 2007 for all funds spending. I have to tell you this, though, beyond the forecasted projections of spending, it is a 1.6% increase for the 2008 to 2009 all fund for above the all funds forecast base. General fund growth for human services is in total, then, 15.4% over the previous biennium, including that forecasted growth. This is the result of both proposed new investments and forecasted growth of existing programs under current law. Growth in utilization and cost of services, as well as the increased enrollment of our participants, account for this increase. These factors alone will increase spending by $1.1 billion, or 13.7% for the previous biennium. That is the forecasted number, to remind you. Strategic new investments for the coming biennium include a health reform effort that addresses quality, access, and cost, and an initiative that improves the mental health system so that people can get more effective care. First, a few words about the healthcare proposal. As you know, the governor has proposed a multi-agency initiative called Healthy Connections. This proposal will bring new value to our healthcare system by emphasizing quality and affordability in both the private sector and public programs. The proposal emphasizes key elements of the governor's Q Care initiative, including encouraging preventive care and streamlining administration. It promotes making insurance affordable, in other words, following the person from job to job. The proposal also makes the current Minnesota Care Program, administered by DHS, work better through eligibility and premium changes. It adds a new product called Minnesota Care 2, designed to help working families, particularly those who work for small employers. The second key investment is in mental health. Many members, at least the incumbent members of this body, have seen much of the elements of this initiative in the last legislative session. The governor's mental health initiative invests $45 million to improve the mental health system, better aligning acute care and mental health care to achieve more effective outcomes for individuals. One in four people experience a mental illness at some point in their lives, including a large percentage of people in need of other social services. While strides have been made in moving from institutional to community-based care, the current system remains fragmented, often requiring people to get sicker in order to receive help. The proposal is based on the recommendation of the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, a group of stakeholders and policymakers that identified concrete plan steps for improving the mental health system. There is growing momentum both here in Minnesota and nationally for addressing both of these issues. I look forward to working with you to find common ground so we can make this year the year that we move ahead on significant health care and mental health reforms. Overall, the governor's budget proposals for human services emphasize quality and value, paying for performance and not just quality. Examples do include the creation of a voluntary system under which providers of publicly funded child care are rewarded for higher quality care. Expansion of QCARE's pay-for-performance initiative for cardiac diseases and continuation of the initiative for diabetic care. The proposal would reward providers for optimal care based on outcomes. It also would link a portion 0.5%, half of a percent, of a 2% rate increase for nursing homes, linking it to quality measures. The budget also advances DHS priorities to help vulnerable children, the elderly, and the homeless. These proposals will help children under state guardianship find safe, loving, permanent homes by increased funding for adoption assistance and relative custody assistance. People who are elderly to stay in their homes or make informed choices about assisted living alternatives. And people who are homeless by increasing funding for the supportive services as part of the governor's initiative to end long-term homelessness. In addition, the governor's budget helps address in the short term the significant anticipated loss of federal funding supporting core county case management. You'll hear quite a bit, I'm sure, during this session, and these services for the certain vulnerable populations. Together, this package of proposals will continue Minnesota's strong tradition of providing help at times of need with a renewed emphasis on quality and value. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If there were any questions or comments, I would entertain those. Otherwise, I will turn this over to our Chief Financial Officer.
Are there questions for the Commissioner? Representative Aber.
I presume we're going to get through the whole book by the end of the hour. Is that let me just ask one question, if I may. It's a kind of an overall question for the Commissioner. Can you just comment on your last question, your last statement about how you're going to backfill the $80-90 million? Can you expand on that for about 30 seconds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Aber, until we know what the federal rules of engagement are about what is going to happen with federal funding for targeted case management, the governor has put in a $40 million, albeit one-time funding alternative to be able to say that we may have some way to mitigate some of the effect, that it is not the total amount for total mitigation of the effect of the federal changes. That's transparent. But until we know the federal rules, they were supposed to be published by the end of last year, in 2006, and yet we do not know whether quite yet.
Thank you. Representative Bunn.
Yes, Chair Huntley, Commissioner. Regarding the issue of the toll increase that's being proposed, I'd just like a little clarification on how much of that is cost increases versus utilization increases. And in particular in the context that we have this discussion about that we have inflation on the revenue side of the budget but not on the expenditure side of the budget. I know that in fact we do have cost adjustments on the forecast on this part of the budget. Is when you include here the cost of services is in the forecast already, is it within every category, some categories, what portion of the budget had some automatic forecasts for cost increases?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, I think our folks will be able to answer that more sufficiently. Most of this is simply medical care contracting. Mm-hmm. And the cost of medical care is provided also in our fee-for-service programs. Mm-hmm. It's a combination of both medical trend increases for those costs and the additional people of which are enrolled.
Mm-hmm.
The governor did use a number. I think the budget figures will, I hope this won't be a conflict, but it depends on how you gauge the increase in enrollment. You could say it's as low as 17,000 new people will be enrolled,
mm-hmm.
but there's considerable churn. A technical word, C-H-U-R-N-E, in the world of health care insurance. Many people go in and out of programs at a constant basis, particularly in public program health care, whether it be Minnesota Care, GAMC, or all of our Medicaid, even fee-for-service populations. They come in and out at a very constant rate. It is the number of people that we have to serve, as well as that medical trend, which results in that forecasted number of $1.1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
But isn't just, it's important to know that it's more people, mm-hmm. as well as also the what is called healthcare inflation, mm-hmm. which we're trying to impact greatly through these value propositions that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that helps. You'll get more detail from everybody that you talk to, I'm sure, from our departments. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner, and I will say I'm very interested in the governor's pay-for-performance initiatives, his Q-Care, and that we will have some hearings just on those kinds of items, because one of the things that I'm very interested in is improving the value, the quality of health care and lowering the cost at the same time, which I think there's all kinds of opportunities to do in our health care system. And I know the governor and you have taken a lead in that, and this committee will be very interested in those issues.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Hardwick, would you state your name for the record?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jane Wilcox Hardwick from the Department of Human Services. My role here today will to be just to take a few minutes to orient you to the materials that you have before you that other folks from the department will be walking through at a more detailed level, and then also to talk briefly about our budget structure to give you a sense of that construct as we go forward. The materials that you have before you include a combination of what is considered the governor's official budget recommendation, and those are all of the white pages in the three-ring binder that you have. The colored pages are those pages that we have included that we felt would be useful to you as you go through the budget and as you learn a little bit more about the human services programs. And I'll take a moment to sort of orient you to those materials. At first, the table of contents at the beginning, you'll notice that our budget is split into a number of programs and budget activities. And as fiscal analyst Walls alluded to before with the other single page that you had, there are individual budget activities that are part of the budget. Some of those are in the jurisdiction of this committee. The book that you have has the whole array of the human services budget, so it has those pieces that will be reviewed by other committees as well. So as individual assistant commissioners and the deputy commissioner come forward, they will be going through the budget activities, or what more traditionally might be referred to as programs, in their individual areas. Immediately behind the table of contents, you will find a transmittal letter that has been submitted by Commissioner Ludeman that echoes the information that he provided just moments ago, as well as immediately behind that, the agency profile and the fiscal information associated with the whole agency. So that provides you an overview of the number of people we serve, the breadth of programs that the agency manages. And then what I would like to do is take a few moments and take you toward the back of the book in the green section, which is our appendix. These are all supplemental materials that we are providing just to for additional background and reference as you go through the budget. And if I could just take a moment, starting on page A1, immediately behind the second page in the green section, and talk a little bit about our budget structure. You'll see there a table, again it's A1 that shows up sort of a matrix of our budget makeup. On the left-hand side, you'll see that there are budget activities that range from what are called forecast grants to non-forecast grants to administration. And our budget is split up into those categories. The forecast grants, for those of you who are not familiar with forecasted programs, are those programs for which the legislature still appropriates resources, but under which state law requires that we enroll and provide services to individuals that are qualified. So in the event that the resources that were appropriated for the individuals enrolled in those programs is either inadequate or above the required need, the Department of Finance comes forward with a forecast and requests that the legislature adjust the appropriation for those programs. So essentially, for example, in the medical assistance program, for most components of that program, if an individual meets the statutory requirements for the program, we enroll them, they are provided services, and we cover and pay for those services, and ask that the legislature adjust the appropriation accordingly under current statute. Most of those programs are what folks often call entitlement programs. I don't believe that's an official term in terms of the statutory construct, but that's often how people think about those programs. Yeah. And they range from medical assistance to our MFIP program for cash for folks, general assistance, our long-term care payments for folks in nursing homes, that sort of thing. The second category are non-forecast grants. Those are all programs that we, for which the department has appropriated a capped grant amount and in which we must manage. Some of these are programs into which individuals enroll. In certain cases, we have waiting lists to get into those programs because the resources don't align with the number of folks who would qualify for the programs. In other cases, we do things like adjust cost sharing, et cetera, so that we can serve as many people as possible within the resources that are available.
Representative Liebling, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to stop you for 1 second and ask what might be a very basic question, but when you're talking about the so-called entitlements and the growth of those, what's automatically being included in there is just growth in numbers of people, correct? You're not including anything in there in terms of any inflation factor, for example, for reimbursements for providers.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the forecast assumes changes in enrollment, changes in utilization of both services and the amount of cash grant programs for those that are cash grant programs, as well as in certain circumstances changes in price that are established in the statute. One example of a change in price that we account for in the forecast is the change in the ingredient cost for prescription drugs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just go into that a little bit more, what kinds of things would be included, and you know, that's one example, but just lay that out a little bit more, what is in the forecast and what is not.
Madam Chair, at some later point, perhaps we could have our forecaster before you to talk a little bit more about that. Generally, the forecast reflects what state law applies in terms of prices for services that we pay for. In most cases, the statute describes in a fairly prescriptive manner the payment rates that will be used for services that are purchased under the health care programs, for example. In some cases, the statute directs the commissioner to negotiate rates or directs counties to negotiate rates in contracts for certain services, for example, chemical dependency services. In other cases, the rates are negotiated under statutory authority for both changes in price and expectations around utilization, for example, our managed care rates.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair. The next category, the bottom line, you will see below there, includes our administrative budget activities. Those in the first column are those associated with agency-wide administration, for example, our financial operations area, our rent costs, those sorts of things are generally included in the agency management category. And then we have administrative budget activities associated with each of the individual sort of subject or program areas that are responsible for managing those individual programs. The other point that I may be useful that's not on this page but might be just a very brief explanation of direct appropriations versus statutory, and perhaps you've had some information about that. Part of our budget is based on direct appropriations, and those are appropriations that the legislature makes for up to a two-year period. And that's what most of the attention, frankly, is given to in the budget process, because an action needs to be taken to address the coming biennial budget. The other part of our budget is what's often referred to as statutory appropriations, and you'll see those referenced in the fiscal pages as we go through. Those are appropriations that occur based on statutory law that isn't typically changed every year or two, that direct certain resources to the agency as an appropriation. And one example of that would be federal Medicaid match that is statutorily appropriated to the department to make payments for the medical assistance program. The other materials in the green section include a series of charts that give you sort of a big picture of the agency's budget. And if I might direct you to page A2, the state budget by agency, you'll see in that all funds fiscal year 08-09 expenditures chart on the top left-hand side, that pie chart, that in the 08-09 base, human services is about 38% of the state's budget. And then going below, taking the same cut, but in the general fund, human services is about 28% of the state's budget. And as we continue through the program descriptions today and in subsequent meetings, the breadth of programs that fall into these expenditures will become more clear. The following page on A3 breaks down our budget within human services. The 08-09 base for human services is $21.9 billion. That does not include the governor recommendation for change items. About 80% of the base, but 75 to 80% of the base budget is related to health care. And I believe Commissioner Luneman alluded to that earlier. That includes things like basic health care services that we cover for lower income folks, Minnesota care expenditures, long-term care expenditures, nursing home expenditures, state-operated services, provision of mental health services, a broad array of health care services. So that is the bulk of the department's budget. Below, you will also see a breakdown in the 08-09 base of the FTEs in the department. It's the base is based on a point in time when the budget was actually, the base budget was established last fall, and that was about 6,900 FTEs in the agency. You'll see by that chart that the bulk of the FTEs in the department are those that are in state-operated services. About 67% of our FTEs are those folks that provide direct care to individuals receiving mental health treatment in our facilities, to those folks who are sex offenders and those committed as mentally ill and dangerous. The next largest portion of FTEs in the agency, you'll see down below, there is healthcare management. About 12% of our FTEs are in that area. That includes things like Minnesota Care Operations, where we process applications and make eligibility determinations for folks applying for Minnesota Care, as well as our MMIS systems, which does, processes a significant number of claims each year. And you'll, again, get more detail on that. And then the third largest part of our budget in terms of FTEs is in Children and Economic Assistance Management. The primary reason that is a large portion of our FTE count is child support enforcement. And as you'll learn later today, I believe the number of child support enforcement cases that are processed through there. Then what I would then next encourage you to turn to page A7. The remaining charts break down the information we talked about a little bit further. But on A7 is a historical chart of the trends in the FTE counts in our department. Going back, this chart runs from fiscal year 1997 through the base budget in 09. But going back a little bit further, even back to 1995, from 1995 to 2005, the agency's count of FTEs was actually reduced over that period of time. And that was primarily a result of movement of folks in our state-operated services institutions into community placements and into private provider settings. At the same time, we had some growth in Minnesota Care Operations and elsewhere in the agency that offset that to some degree. You'll see now as you look at our FTE base that the total FTEs overall on either the chart above or the total line below is again growing. The majority of that growth has started to occur again beginning in fiscal year 2006, and the bulk of that is related to the growth in state-operated services related to an increase in the number of commitments in that area. So you'll see that there continue to be changes in our FTE counts associated with the number of folks that we're having to serve.
Most of that increase in clients are the sex offenders?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure. We'll have to get back to you on that, Mr. Chair. I don't think we have the folks here today who could answer that breakout. And then the following two charts show central office versus state-operated services, a similar breakout. In central office, the area that I thought would be of use to point out is that our general fund FTE count has actually gone down in the past 10 years. That has occurred as we have increased, proportionately increased the staffing from the Healthcare Access Fund over time. At least for the past several years, the Minnesota Care program enrollment had been increasing. I think you'll see as our forecast information is provided later on Minnesota Care that some of the enrollment trends do not continue to be upward. We also have had increases in the number of people that we've served in licensing and administrative appeals. And those have contributed to the increased staffing in that area. So just, and we'll continue. As we go through the materials, you'll be able to see where the FTEs and the agency are program by program to give you a sense of where those investments are. The other materials in the green section include on the following page on A10, a chart showing the federal poverty guidelines. Many of the income standards for human services programs are based on or tied to federal poverty standards. This material is based on the 2006 guidelines. I believe the 2007 guidelines came out today, and so updated material can be provided at the committee's request.
I would, maybe the pages can do it later, but if you leave your books here, they'll collect them and you won't lose them, so I would recommend you do that. But they could put a post-it note sticking on page 810, because you'll be looking at that page 1,000 times in the next 6 months. And Representative Abra had a question.
Well, thanks. I'm just a little slow on the draw. If you want to go back a page or so, Ms. Hardwick, just to the general, there's a philosophical question about the staffing levels. I was under the impression that staff was really lean and we had lost a ton of staff and the central office was like a ghost town. And looking at these numbers, it seems that it's been steady and now it's going up. Are we doing way more people, or is it way more complex? And they're shifting from the general fund, but are we just shifting the funding stream? That's two questions at once, I guess. And just a short answer, I'll take more later, but just or at least kind of defer an answer later if you can. But I'm surprised by that picture, I guess. So you'll pardon me for asking that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, you may recall, I believe in the 2004 session. The 2005 session, that there was an increase in FTEs appropriated for the department. A combination of that included a number of staff in state-operated services, actually rather significant growth, relatively significant growth in that area, as well as increased staffing in our areas of licensing, administrative appeals, and Minnesota Care Operations. Most of those requests and the granting of those staffing was related to statutory requirements that the department is obligated to comply with, and the increasing caseloads in those areas that were the result of, I think, generally, as you suggested, increasing number of folks that are served on the programs, as well as increased complexity.
Well, that's good for now. I may have more questions later, but thank you.
Mr. Chair, then the following materials, and I will move along more quickly here, include the FSI federal payment standards, a number of programs that often refer to these standards, and there are also individuals who receive services under our programs who are SSI recipients. So, again, that is there for your reference.
Could you describe what SSI means?
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a supplemental security income program. It is a federal income program to provide cash support to low-income people who are elderly or disabled. The following page, A12, is a chart that can give, I think, a good picture of our health care programs. As you will hear later, we have Minnesota Care, medical assistance, general assistance, medical care, some subcomponents of the medical assistance program. Some of those programs are funded fully by state dollars, some with federal Medicaid or state children's health insurance program match. This gives you a picture of those individual programs and subcomponents of populations that are served at the varying income standards. And you can see that that is rather complex in terms of folks varying income standards for different populations in the program. This may be one that you may want to flag as well, I think, as we go through the program. It helps to see that picture. The following page, A13, supplements that with an explanation of coverage under each of those programs. That's just a quick reference tool for you as we cover those programs. And behind that on page A15 is a summary of Medicaid waivers. As I indicated earlier, about half of our budget is federally funded. The bulk of that federal funding is Medicaid, Title 19 Medicaid from the federal government. We obtain those resources in two manners. One is through a state plan, which is consistent with the federal guidelines around Medicaid programs, and then secondly through waivers of state plan requirements. And this lists those areas where we deviate from the state plan to obtain federal match. One of the primary larger waivers includes an 1115 waiver by which we get federal match to do Minnesota Care for much of our Minnesota Care population. And so this is sort of a listing of those, the status of those, and an explanation of those pieces. The next page that I would turn to would be A25. And then behind that, A26, these are fund balance statements for TANF and Healthcare Access Fund. This is the base. With the November forecast, it does not include the governor's recommendation, but will give you a sense of what the resources were available, the revenues to those accounts, as well as the planned expenditures under the November forecast.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
I noticed in the summary sheet that the TANF expenditures are below the forecast. Is that because we're getting less? Or am I right in my read of that? Just a global answer. Are we spending all the TANF we have? Or is there a TANF reserve that we're building?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe there has been an intentional development of a TANF reserve, but due to changes in the November forecast, there is a balance on the bottom line in the TANF account on page 825.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you.
And then lastly, on page 827 is a series of abbreviations and acronyms that we try not to use at the table, but you will occasionally hear folks use these for reference, and it gives you an opportunity to figure out what we're talking about sometimes.
There's 25 pages there, and there'll be a test tomorrow morning.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abler.
This TANF thing just got me going for a second. Is there going to be a TANF day? Or another day to ask questions, because my question is this, and maybe they can answer it now or later, but if there's TANF on the bottom line, in the past, our habit has been to supplant and to shift money to get more leverage out of it, and is that part of the to be happening later, or are we gonna leave the session if this were passed with the reserve, or are we, and if that's true, what keeps us from supplanting and doing other stuff with this money? Is that one of our options?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think the first question is, under the governor's budget recommendation, there would still be a balance in the TANF account at the end of fiscal year 11, and I believe that would be about $17
million. 17, not the 142 that this shows.
And,
okay.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think to your second question, the state does have, I would say, relatively broad authority about how to use TANF resources within the constraints identified in federal law. And there are expenditures both in the general fund that may be appropriate for TANF, appropriately used for TANF. There are other, so there are multiple ways to use TANF resources.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm not advocating to spend every penny. I don't mind that small cushion, so I'm just was curious. Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as we're on TANF, just for a minute, I'm just trying to understand the child care part of that. Is that that's down under the Federal Child Care and Development Fund, right? And is that, which is the bottom part of the page, do you know in the governor's budget, you said that he did some things with TANF? Did he do anything with child care and TANF?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, yes, there are proposals that do affect TANF and child care.
And Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I think we're hearing from you in committee on Thursday, and we'll hear more about those at that time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, I believe that is
okay.
The plan.
Mr. Chair, and I wouldn't mind hearing about that before committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, I believe staff have been in contact with your staff to schedule that.
Thank you.
Or we can hear it all.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I did miss one page. I believe it was A25, and I won't suggest that you go back to it, but just for reference, it does list the cost of living payment adjustments to health care providers over the past 10 years, again, for your reference, as well as a corresponding reference to the Consumer Price Index and Employee Employment Index, so again, for reference. And if there aren't any additional questions sort of on the budget structure or the materials, I would then turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Chuck Johnson to start us off on page 37, which is in the white section. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you also state your name and title for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Chuck Johnson, Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services with the Department of Human Services. Mr. Chair and members, as Ms. Hardwick identified, the budget for Children and Family Services begins on page 37 of your book. I am going to be walking through the budget for believe there are 8 base budget pages that are within CFS and 6 change budget pages. As Mr. Walls identified at the beginning of the hearing, there are a number of accounts within Children and Family Services that are not in the jurisdiction of this committee. So as we're going through the book, I will skip over those and we'll move on to the next identified one that is within the jurisdiction. Mr. Chair, members, Children and Family Services oversees all the major programs that impact families and children within the human services system. This includes our economic assistance programs such as MFIP and food stamp program, child care assistance and child care development efforts, child support enforcement, child welfare services, which includes child protection, foster care, adoption, and so forth. In addition to that, we oversee a number of items that are not directly related to families with kids but are also within our area, such as housing. We have some responsibility for the governor's long-term homeless initiative around supportive services. We also have the group residential housing program. We also oversee the community action agencies, which are 38 agencies spread across the state providing services to low-income families in the community. In addition, we oversee refugee services. Children and Family Services spends something over $2 billion in this biennium. We're projected to spend over half of that is from federal funding. Many of our programs are federal state shared. We'll see that as we go through the budget. You'll see that there's identified both state and federal shares in the programs. Because Minnesota is a state supervised county administered system, a lot of the work that we do at DHS is actually supporting the counties and the work that they do at the local level administering the programs. They're the ones who actually work with the families and the individuals who are in need of services. We oversee the counties in terms of providing training, policy guidance, interpretation. Computer systems are a big part of what we do in order to provide the infrastructure for the services that are being provided locally. Quality control, quality assurance, ensuring compliance, ensuring program improvement, as well as reporting, grant oversight, grant management, and so forth. In terms of the budget proposals that you'll see as we walk through the budget, the changes proposed by the governor, within CFS are really focused in two areas. One is response to federal changes, as Commissioner Ludeman identified, particularly in the area of MFIP and in the area of the threat to county case management funds. We have some initiatives in those areas. And then in addition, we have some strategic investments around some key initiatives where we're trying to make improvements to improve value, to move toward, in some cases, more of a pay-performance kind of mechanism for funding our services, and I'll identify those as we go through. Mr. Chair, the first budget activity page is found on page 40. This is the base budget activity for MFIP and Diversionary Work Program grants. MFIP is the Minnesota Family Investment Program. It is our primary welfare program in Minnesota for families with children. It is often called or referred to interchangeably as welfare reform. This is the initiative that Minnesota took up in 1997 in response to the 1996 federal change in laws governing public assistance. It was based on a pilot that we had started back in the 80s, actually, in long-term development of the MFIP program over that period. This budget page covers the grants that are paid to the individual families, the cash grants, and the food assistance that's paid to MFIP families. It does not cover the services. I'll cover those in a different page a little bit later. The program is for families with minor children who meet the income test for the program. They can retain eligibility up to about 115% of the poverty line. So we have some trade-off. When a family starts to work, they don't exit the program immediately. In 2004, we began the Diversionary Work Program, which is a new part of our welfare efforts in Minnesota. The Diversionary Work Program is essentially a front end that we apply to the MFIP program for new applicants coming into the system. It's a short-term, four-month program. It's very focused on trying to move families, when able, into work as quickly as possible to prevent the need for those families to have to come onto the MFIP program. The Diversionary Work Program doesn't count any months toward the family's 60-month time limit, so it's an advantage for the family if they can take advantage of that program and move into work to not have to come into the MFIP program. Mr. Chair, I would note on page 41, the bar chart that's at the top of the page, because we'll be having significant discussions, I expect, during the course of this legislative session about the federal work participation rates, which I will speak to in a minute. This bar chart that shows here is not the federal work participation rate, which is called a TANF work participation rate. This is an MFIP work participation rate, which is actually a state creation that we use to measure county performance. And it's the measure we have been using up until now, but we're proposing to move over to using more of the standard federal measure for measuring county performance because of the new pressure that's going to come with the changes from the federal level. And just for a point of orientation, for 2006, the state's performance under the TANF work participation rate, as measured by the federal government, was 32.6%. So this chart, while it is an accurate display of one measure, is not the measure we're going to end up talking about a lot over the next several months. Similar, but not the same. Mr. Chair, the financing page for this activity is on page 43 in your budget book, about $540 million over the biennium. And as you can see, this includes both federal and state general fund dollars. The federal dollars are provided through the TANF Temporary Assistance for Needy Family Block Grant.
Representative Abler.
I have two, and when you break, I'll go back to ask my other question. But on the standard you're talking about, I had something passed the House that wasn't adopted in conference committee last year. Is that what you're talking about, this kind of getting away from the state and more to the federal standard?
Representative Abler, that's correct. I think you had a bill that related to how the counties were held accountable for meeting the work participation rate. What we're looking at and what we're actually proposing is we had this work participation rate that we called the MPIP work participation rate. Let me back up a little bit. Work participation rate is a federal construction as to how they measure our performance in the welfare program. Essentially what it is of the families within our, in our case, MFIT program, or in the state's TANF program, how many of those families are participating in identified, defined work activities for a certain number of hours a week, all of which is governed by federal regulations. And there's a percentage target that the state has to meet. That percentage target, until TANF was reauthorized and signed by the president last year, had been low enough so that Minnesota had never been at great risk of not meeting the rate under the federal law and potentially incurring penalties that come with not meeting the rate. With reauthorization, and we'll get to a budget change phase that addresses this in a second, we are going to have to push much harder to meet our federal work participation rate in order to be in a position to avoid being penalized by the federal government for not performing. Back to your question, Representative Abler. We have been using a measure that was more representative of how Minnesota constructed our program rather than just the straight federal rate, which is a little bit more complicated in terms of who's in the rate and who's out of the rate and so forth. Because of the need to push toward meeting the federal rate, we're going to align the way we measure our performance and the county's performance with the way the feds are measuring it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if there's no other questions on that page, I turn to the first change page.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just briefly say what the changes were, or are you going to get that in your change page in terms of what the feds have to
do? Mr. Representative Thiessen, I was just about to do that.
Okay.
You anticipated. The first change page is on page 44 in your budget book, labeled MFIP Federal Compliance. This is the governor's proposal for the response to the federal reauthorization of TANF. Excuse me. The federal government passed reauthorization of TANF last year. For those of you that have been following this, TANF was scheduled to be reauthorized in 2002, and the debate just sort of strung out, and they kept extending us for little chunks at a time. And then finally last year, as part of the Deficit Reduction Act, they did reauthorize TANF, but in a way that really wasn't consistent at all with what we had expected, given the debate that had been going on for several years, in a much different way, in a sense, in a more limited way. But what they did is, I mentioned the work participation rate earlier, previous to the reauthorization of TANF, states had a target work participation rate we had to meet. And for all states, for the last several years, that had been set at 50%, meaning going back to what I was talking before, 50% of our caseload had to be engaged in these work activities for a certain number of hours a week. The law also included something called a caseload reduction factor, which allowed us to subtract from that 50% target the amount that our caseload had gone down since 1995. In the case of Minnesota, our caseload had gone down 35-36% since 1995. So the effective rate we had to meet as a state was 15% as a target. As I said before, we were performing 32% in 2006, so we had quite a cushion in terms of meeting that federal requirement. What the federal law did in this sort of limited form of reauthorization is left in the caseload reduction credit but rebased it to 2005, meaning that now we're going to be measured in the caseload reduction credit against our caseload reduction from a 2005 baseline instead of 1995. Minnesota and all states experienced the vast chunk of our caseload reduction in the latter part of the 90s when welfare reform first came in. And so our caseload has been more stable since then. And so we're not going to have that kind of a generous caseload reduction to offset that target we need to meet. Our estimate for 2006 is that we have about a 5% caseload reduction factor, so we're going to have around a 45% target to meet. And as I mentioned before, we're at about 32.6 right now. This page addresses in several ways our effort to try to improve our chances of meeting the work participation rate and thus avoid the federal penalties that would come with that. There are three primary proposals here and then three additional proposals, and I'll walk through them each in turn.
Interrupt you for a second. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't mean to interrupt. I'm just kind of curious that with those federal changes in the reauthorization, how many states were kicked into that situation of the penalties? I'm just kind of curious what happened overall.
Mr. Representative Broad, I can't answer that for sure because we don't have all the measurements from other states. The law was effective October of 06, so we're now under the new regime in terms of how we're being measured. The last year that we have data across all the states is 2004, and there were, I believe, six or eight states that would have exceeded a 50% rate in 2004 based on their own performance. But one issue with that is they were meeting that rate, whatever it was, something over 50%, under the old rules. The other thing that the reauthorization did was allowed it, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services to regulate the definition of work activities and to regulate the work verification procedures that states had to have in order to actually verify that somebody had really done the amount of work activity that we're saying they did in our report to the feds. That's going to make it a lot harder, and we know from anecdotally and talking with other states and going to meetings, a lot of states had taken very creative definitions of the work activities and some creative definitions of how they accounted whether or not somebody was really participating. We fortunately didn't do a lot of that in Minnesota, so we're not in that bad a position, but we are still lower in terms of where our starting rate is. The problem becomes we don't really know where we're starting from because we're under new regulations and we only have our past experience. And every other state is in the same situation. I think some are looking probably at a much more dramatic situation because they had been, a little bit more generous in how they were defining the work activities. The regulations from HHS came out in June, and they are very specific and very not giving states a lot of flexibility in all on what these work activities are, and quite onerous, frankly, in terms of the kinds of verification procedures that we have to have in place of verifying every hour that someone's participating, having that documentation and case file, and oversight from the state to make sure the counties are actually doing that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the first piece of our proposal to address the work participation rate challenge is to work with the counties to develop specialized employment for hard-to-place MPIP participants. This would provide grants to counties to create both paid and unpaid work experience positions for MPIP recipients. We estimate that we could work with approximately 2,400 participants under this program. These would be placements that would help folks who have not had success finding a job in the private labor market to get a placement in either a subsidized job or an unpaid work experience job to build some skills, to build some work experience that can help them to make a transition into regular paid employment. This money is really seed money to the counties to get them to do the activity to start generating these kinds of placements. This kind of activity is one of the few things in the federal law that counts as work for the purposes of the work participation rate. It's not something we've done a lot of in Minnesota over the course of time. We've focused much more on trying to move families into regular employment in the paying labor market. But we believe in order to meet the work participation rate, we're going to need to get more engaged in this kind of activity, in these kind of paid and unpaid work experience kinds of positions in order to get the number of people we need in to meet the work participation rate.
Commissioner, could you just give some examples of the type of work these people might be doing?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. The statute, this would be in a part of the statute that already specifies that the work has to provide some kind of community value. So what we'd be looking for is, and counties to differing degrees are doing some of this now, so it's really trying to build on some of that that's already happening. This could include placements doing environmentally related work. It could include a placement in a nonprofit that provides some kind of a service to the community, doing some kind of administrative work or reception work or something that would support that nonprofit and its work. Could be work in the community healthcare sector that would also provide that kind of opportunity. So it's within, looking at folks who have not been successful and trying to match them with a position that would give them some work experience and some skills in a position that has some benefit to the community.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You can have a short answer now, but I'd like to get some more information about the experience in other states and whether this has actually gotten people in a position where they can get into paying jobs that are working. I don't know if you have anything off the top of your head, but it would be helpful to get some more background on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we can get that information for you. The track record isn't that great in terms of what kind of impetus this provides to getting folks into paid employment. But it is helpful in terms of meeting the work participation rate. And the other benefit that I didn't mention is sometimes this is a helpful way for the job counselor, the staff people who are working with the family to, or the individual, to identify what has been going wrong. If they've been placing the person, they're losing jobs, to put them into a placement where there's some supervision that's connected to the job counselor, they can understand, is there something going on with this family, and maybe even identify another issue that needs to be dealt with in the mental health arena or something else. So it's almost sort of an assessment tool for some of those who have been not making good progress toward paid employment.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding this proposal, the counties, are you also giving money to the tribes? And what's the mechanism for overseeing these two situations, counties and tribes, and also what will be the consequence if things aren't... I see things happening with counties now that aren't being fulfilled, and I'm wondering, is there going to be some kind of mechanism in place to enforce this here and get some good results from it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the mechanism that we have in place right now is really twofold. There is as part of the dollars that the counties get to provide services to MFIP participants, which is in the next base budget page I'm coming to, counties have to submit us a biennial service, what's called a service agreement. And the service agreement has to lay out that the county's goal for improvement on the measures that we use for measuring county performance, which are actually on the previous page, the work participation rate and the self-support index. And the county has to lay out the strategies for achieving performance to do that. So we oversee that through watching what they're doing, looking in the next cycle to see if they made improvement. Additionally, and probably somewhat more forcefully, the consolidated fund, 5% of the consolidated fund funding for each county is earned based on performance, and they need to perform both in terms of the self-support index measure, which is on the previous page, and in terms of the work participation rate. If they don't perform on one or the other, they could lose up to 5% or 2.5% of the dollars that they would otherwise get for services. So we've taken the allocation formula, and we had 95% of it is the traditional allocation formula based on where cases are in historical spending. The other 5% we placed on performance. Which I think has worked pretty well over the last several years to get counties very engaged in trying to meet the work participation rate and why we have made some improvement over the last several years.
So Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What about the tribal aspect of it? You mentioned here counties and tribes. Is that going to be the same situation?
Mr. Sheriff, said mentioned, yes, it's the same mechanisms that are in place for the counties that are in place for the tribes. There are five tribes that deliver services, employment services under the MFIP program to the members of their band.
Thank you.
Commissioner. Representative Leffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. My question was what the status is for the clients that might be enrolled in this new CWEP program. Would they be eligible for child care? It says it's paid or unpaid work. How does whether it's paid or it's unpaid affect the grant funding level?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. All MFIP families that are engaged in approved work activities are eligible for child care assistance, so these families would receive child care assistance since this is an approved activity. In terms of their grant, if they were, if it was an unpaid placement, the grant wouldn't change. If it were a paid placement, the grants are budgeted as earnings, and the grant would go down by some amount. There's a 38% disregard, which means we don't count 38% of earnings. The other 62% are essentially counted against the grant, and then their benefit will be lowered by that amount. Mr. Chair and members, the next proposal around meeting the work participation rate involves two policy changes that would affect the participants in the MFIP program. The first is to shorten the sanction period and align the post-60-month sanction policies. Sanctions refer to the reduction in benefits that a family experiences if they're not cooperating with the work requirements of the MFIP program. Under current law, if a family is not cooperating with the work requirements or with the requirement to assign child support, the grant is reduced 10% in the first month, 30% for each of the next 5 months, and then in the essentially the seventh month, if they're still not cooperating, then their grant is terminated and the family is no longer on assistance. They can come back on by getting back into cooperation and so forth, but that's the process of how the sanction works. It's essentially a partial sanction for 6 months and then what was called a full family or 100% sanction in the seventh month.
Now, Mr. Commissioner, could you, what percentage of the MFIP participants are under sanction?
Mr. Chair, I believe that it is in the range of about 10% now. It's about 1,700 families in the last report. That would be somewhat less than 10%, probably more like 5%. I can check and get you an exact number.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, the federal work participation rate definition deals with sanctions in this way. It says if you have a person in a partial sanction, like our 10 or 30% sanction, for up to 3 months, they won't make them count against your work participation rate. That's essentially get to remove them out and say, well, okay, even though they're not working, it's not counting against us. After that point, if we still have them in a partial sanction, we have to put them back into the calculation, and because, of course, they're not working, because they're in sanction, they would then essentially count against us as a non-working family. Our proposal is to align the state's sanction policy with that federal rule so that, we have a partial sanction for only 3 months before we would move to the full sanction. That would affect 300 families a month by our estimate. That would work sort of similar to now, but shorter, 10% in the first month, and then 2 months at 30%, and then the full family sanction would follow. Mr. Chair, the second policy change in that area relates to the employment plan. Currently, under MFIP, a person or family comes in and applies for assistance. They are determined eligible for assistance, and then after they're determined eligible for assistance and they get their benefits, they're referred, usually to another agency, counties usually contract this service, to someone, to an employment counselor or an agency to develop an employment plan. That employment plan then guides the work that they have to do in terms of meeting the work requirements and trying to move toward employment. Under this proposal, we would propose to move MFIP more in the direction that we moved 2 years ago, 3 years ago, with the diversionary work program, which is to require that the employment plan come before the approval of benefits. This would not affect diversionary work program cases or cases that transition from the diversionary work program to MFIP, nor would it affect child-only cases, which are cases in our MFIP case bill where the parent is often receiving SSI, which is federal disability assistance, and the children are receiving the MFIP benefit. Those cases would not be affected by this. The benefit of doing this from a perspective of work participation rate is that we would get families engaged more quickly into countable work activities and not have the lag of a month or 2 months that sometimes happens at the front end of the program before, as a family is moving from one agency to the other to get the employment plan put in place.
Representative Abler,
how's that going to go in the Senate for these two things, do you think? I guess we'll wait and see.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I haven't done that presentation yet.
Representative Slavik.
Mr. Chair, just a question about that. It seems like, and you know, you've heard me talk about this, is one thing I'm interested in doing is making things easier for families. I mean, I know it's sanctions, but does it in essence, might cause a delay, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slavik, potentially could cause a delay. We would build into the statute timelines the counties would have to meet for turning around these transactions so that the delay would not be too long. But it would require that this would have to happen first, and it would make it a little bit more difficult for participants to maneuver through that system at the front end before they get their benefits.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slavik.
Just a follow-up. Do any of the proposals make it smoother or less paperwork for the families?
Mr. Representative Slaw, I'm coming up on one that might fall into that category.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I'm hoping that when the bills come forward and we have a more complete discussion on this, that the information provided just will just be a little more expanded, because I keep hearing the focus towards achieving our participation goals, which are important because we don't want to be federally sanctioned. But I want to hear about how this is successfully helping families to move towards self-sufficiency and how it's helping them in crisis. I mean, typically when a family comes to apply for MFIP, they're in crisis. They may have decided to go through a divorce or they've been declared, you know, their spouse has said, I'm leaving and I'm not paying anything until the court tells me how much. I mean, and they're in a financial crisis. And to put upon them at that point in time a sanction until they can get referred to a qualified community agency that will help them think through options and get them back into the workforce if they've been a homemaker, really is a penalty on that family. Well, and we need to consider that as we consider the penalties on us on the state. And I'm thinking that it might actually reduce the quality of our programs because if people just slap together anything on an employment plan that isn't really thought through about what the jobs are in the local economy and that sort of thing, we might actually improve our participation rate but actually have less success in getting those people out of programs like CWEP into to long-term stable employment. And so I'm hoping that, you know, we'll address multiple goals at the same time. And I'm not saying you're not doing that. I just hope that in the when you come back, we'll hear a lot more, as Representative Thiessen has said, about, you know, what have other states had success at? What have counties within Minnesota had success in that? What kind of models can we look to implement this?
Commissioner. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to quickly follow up on what Representative Loeffler is saying. And I hope that what I think I'm hearing from this is that what you're talking about is essentially shifting the risk of a delay in getting this plan together from the county to the family. And I think that that could be problematic. I don't know a lot about how all of this works, but just following on what Representative Loeffler was saying, I would really like to hear a lot more about that before we get to the end.
We can get into that more when we bring the bill to you, and then you can see what the timelines are, which I think is essentially the protection against that, is to say that the county needs to do this in this period of time, and if not, then you would be able to issue the benefit. So I think that that's probably the piece that would help with that, and I don't have that right in front of me right now. To describe it in the detail, I think would be helpful. Mr. Chair, the next proposal that we have in the work participation rate area is actually more complicated than anything I've discussed so far, if you can imagine that. This regards which families are part of our TANF work participation rate, not just how many are working, but which ones actually, when the federal government looks at us, which ones are they counting? And we're proposing to move certain families within our MFIP program out of the realm of what the federal government will be looking at when they count the work participation rate. The new federal law makes this somewhat more challenging to do than it was in the past. The way that this is done is essentially by shifting families to a different funding source. These proposals that I'm going to talk about are budget neutral. It is simply a matter of how we're pointing funds and which funds we're using to fund certain families and how we're reporting that then to the federal government. Under the federal regulations, if you fund a family with TANF dollars, the federal dollars, or with the maintenance of effort dollars that the state is required to put up under the 96 law, then they have to be part of your work participation rate. The federal work participation rate, though, has no jurisdiction over what we do with state dollars that are not being counted as TANF MOE. What we're proposing to do is essentially take some families who are now funded with some combination of TANF and general fund MOE dollars and move them over to general fund non-MOE dollars, meaning dollars that are not within the maintenance of effort of the federal TANF program. And by doing that, those families then won't count anymore in our work participation rate. And as you might expect, we're trying to target families who we think are struggling more to meet the work participation rates and for whom, frankly, a program that is more aggressive in trying to move people to work probably isn't the appropriate kind of service that they need to be receiving right now. This is done in a budget-neutral way, as I suggested before. It's possible for us to do this in part because what is allowable to count as MOE under the federal TANF law, what they allow to count as MOE, we have a lot of in Minnesota, and so we're able to call this money MOE or that money MOE at sort of our own leisure as to where we want to move people. It's not unlimited, but we have enough to do some certain amount of maneuvering with these dollars. There are three groups that we're proposing to move to the non-MOE funding, in total of about 3,200 cases within the MFIP program. The first group, and this would be effective March 1st of 2008, are a group that would be identified at the 24th month on assistance. There's a regular annual review of families, so this would be done coincident with that review, who are not meeting the work participation rate and are identified as having a disability that's preventing them from working or working successfully. Those are families who then at that point we would move into this non-MOE program. They would continue to be part of, have work requirements and potentially have sanctions in the time limit. We would use a modified work plan, which is something that's already allowed under the current law, which would look more at what their limitations and barriers are in terms of what they can do under a work plan rather than sort of the approach that would be implied by the federal work participation rate, which is a more aggressive move toward comfortable work. The second group, which would be effective 10-1-07 in the governor's proposal, are newly arrived refugees who have been in the country less than 12 months. We propose that the first 6 months that these refugee families are on assistance, that we would also move them to the non-MOE funding stream. These are families who are obviously trying in the first few months that they get to the country to get oriented to being in the United States. And so a lot of the service we end up providing, both through the NFIP program but also through refugee services and some of the grants in that area, is really toward helping to get settled in housing and doing some of the other things, getting their kids into school, none of which counts in terms of the work participation rates under the feds. So we propose to allow those families to spend 6 months in the non-MOE program before we move them into the work program and into the counting of the work participation rate. And then finally, the last group that we would propose moving over are cases that are extended beyond the 60-month time limit. When Minnesota implemented the 60-month time limit, we created categories of individuals or families who can be continue to receive assistance past 60 months. These are largely people who are experiencing some kind of an illness or disability, caring for someone in their home who is ill or disabled. And so we have a number of families who are in that extended category right now, who are, because we're funding them with TANF, are in our work participation rate. We propose to move those families into the non-MOE as well. As I said, across these three categories, that totals about 3,200 cases that we would be moving out of the work participation rate, keeping them within the MFIP program, but doing it in a different way with a different funding source and allowing modified employment plans so we can work with those families in a more constructive way at the level that they're able to engage.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I'm just looking for the free lunch. I was, Cody, where are these numbers specified? There's a huge chart on the page 48 and 44 shows we're spending $2 million for all this. But the state share on, you know, there's $3 million and $1 million and $8 million. And is that all hidden in this somewhere to come up for $2 million? Or is another $20 million page somewhere that I missed for the proposals on page 46?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I don't believe that dollar shifting is actually shown on this page at all. The shifting, it's mentioned, if you look at the paragraph toward the bottom of page 46, the total amount is about $9 million in fiscal year 08, $9.5 million, and $15.3 million in the years going forward of dollars that would be shifted around to do this. I don't believe, unless somebody corrects me, that it's on the budget page here.
Mr.
Representative Abler.
And I don't, if the chart looks like the one on page 48, it's not going to happen.
That's the one
right
I was
now.
Looking at.
But so all that $9 million or dollars is accounted for in a net of 2.6? Is that in terms of net state outlay change?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, all that maneuvering is budget neutral.
Really?
We're shifting around the $9 million. We're not adding $9 million in cost, and that's why it doesn't show up here. Okay. What we're doing essentially is taking families who are currently being funded with using TANF, or MOE dollars, moving them over here to essentially say we're going to fund them with general fund only, and we're not going to count that. We're not going to report to the feds to say this is maintenance of effort for our TANF program. Instead, we're going to find $9 million over here, and I believe we're looking at the working family credit to do this, and say this is the $9 million that's MOE now, not this $9 million over here.
Oh.
And so from the federal purposes, we're still meeting our MOE requirement, but we're keeping, we're giving some families the ability to not have to be under the work participation rate and giving ourselves the opportunity to work with them in a different way and not have to try to push to have them meet the unrealistic requirements.
Did Mr. Hansen have to pass that test to become commissioner to understand your mechanism for this one? We'll have to ask him next time we see him. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Huntley. Commissioner, these changes now have to be learned by the counties, correct? The county employees. Once again, they're a little complicated. I know there are not huge numbers, but to what extent will counties receive training, the employees, that is, who have to account for this?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, certainly the counties will be trained on these changes so they understand them. A lot of this piece will be done by the Maxis computer system, which is a state resource, so that it won't be something the counties actually have to do. We'll shift around the funding. We'll give them alerts and ways to identify which families are in which category so that they can track and provide the appropriate services to families. Mr. Chair, three additional proposals that are packaged within this page. The first is we proposing to remove some hourly restrictions that are now in place on some of the activities in MFIP, particularly English as a second language, adult basic education, functional work literacy. There are currently some restrictions on how many hours or what percentage of a person's plan can be engaged in those activities. We feel that in order to provide service to individuals, and particularly those who have English challenges with the English language, a limited English proficiency population, we'd like to have more flexibility to be able to work across and not have those barriers in place, given the challenges we have with work participation rates. Mr. Chair, this page also proposes two FTEs for the department for a quality assurance system to oversee the new federal regulations on the verification of work activities. As I mentioned, there are new federal regulations that are going to require at the local level, which means counties or the contracted agencies in Minnesota, to verify the hours that people are participating in activities, to have those activities documented in files in certain ways on a daily basis, and it's quite a complex system. That law also requires states to oversee that process. In order to do that, we're asking for two positions. We're estimating that we need to have a minimum of 400 case reviews that we do in a year. That's actually going out, looking in the files, making sure the documentation is there, providing corrective action, helping to train the counties on what's supposed to be there so that we can continue to comply and improve over time with our compliance. And we're requesting two FTEs for that. And then finally, as I mentioned before, we're proposing for the purposes of performance and then consolidated fund to align the work participation rate we use to measure county performance with the TANF work participation rate definition rather than the current state law definition of work participation that we have now. That would be aligned with the federal definition and whatever changes Minnesota makes to it coming out of this legislative session. So, for instance, if we do remove families, as I've just talked about on the previous page, that would be the way the counties would be measured, is on those families who are in the work federal work participation rate, not on those who were removed into the non-MOE. Mr. Chair, and as Representative Abel identified on page 48, is the financing for this set of proposals.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Abel,
at the risk of getting into this, and I don't want to, but can you just tell me, Commissioner, why there's no numbers like $10 million and a million, and that add up to this big number that is on page 46. At least he shifted around here. These are all pretty small denominations. Is there something that we're just off this page? Don't tell me. I mean, just is that covered here still, or is that some way of it? Or?
Mr. Chair, it's not covered here. I would look to someone else to see whether it's covered anywhere in the budget book, if there is a place to look for it.
And I don't want too much detail, and this is the overview day, I know, so just the highlight would be fine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Barb Julek from the Department of Human Services. I believe the numbers you're referring to on the bottom of page 46, which is the summary of all the MOE shifts. These are budget-neutral changes in the general fund. Basically, we are taking our current general fund spending in MFIP and splitting it between MOE and non-MOE spending. So we're spending no more or no less money than we currently project in the general fund. In order to backfill against the MOE shift, we are taking current spending in the work and family credit and counting that as MOE. So again, no additional work and family credit spending. It's just what we count as MOE.
Mr. Chair, so there's surplus MOE dollars floating around that you can still access. Is that
correct? We're using surplus work and family credit.
MOE. Yeah, I'm liking page 46. I'm not, don't get me wrong. I just, thanks a lot.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just can you tell me what the coding means on this page 48, what fund 315 is? just so I can follow that a little better.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, 315 is TANF.
And 300?
300 is other federal dollars. In this case, it refers in the line to the Child Development Fund, which is a block grant we get from the Feds for child care funding.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, and 100 is?
General fund.
General fund. Okay, and what's that? And Mr. Chair, that next column?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, I believe that's just a way of coding what budget activity things are paid out of, which are identified on the base budget pages.
Okay, thank you.
To track that kind of stuff.
Representative Slowick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Johnson. It feels a little bit gimmicky to me, you know, like when they needed to have manufacturing jobs be at a certain level, they just changed the definition of manufacturing and made them service jobs so they qualified, and that's somewhat what we're doing, just to we're avoiding penalties, we're changing how we're counting them. So I hope we take a closer look at that. As far as on page 47, the proposal for quality assurance, is there any chances for waivers on that, or are we doing something like that? Is there any chance to, and I know a lot of states do this, they just get around the compliance by using another mechanism. Do we have anything in place right now?
Mr. Chair and Representative Slowick, no, we don't have anything in place now that really oversees that kind of documentation of the work activities at that level. There is, in the new federal law, a penalty associated with not complying with these verification procedures and the oversight. So we're concerned about it just from the compliance perspective. We don't want to lose any additional TANF block grant dollars simply because we're not complying with these kind of process things. There's no waiver authority available under the federal law on any of this. Under the way the law is currently written, there's really not a lot of flexibility. To your first point about this being gimmicky, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that characterization, but I would say that this is the game that we've been given by the federal government. This is the way that they want to approach this program. And from our perspective, we want to put ourselves in the best position to meet it, certainly, so we don't lose any federal dollars. But also, I think there's an opportunity here to be thinking about who is in our MFIP caseload. We've learned a lot over the last 10 years, and one of the things we've learned is it's not a homogenous group of families. There are some folks that can leave assistance pretty quickly without a lot of help. There are some folks who need some help but can get to work and successfully transition. There are a lot of other people with additional kinds of challenges. And some of those are the folks that we're representing here in this page, is to say, look, I don't know if it makes a lot of sense for us to be running this aggressive kind of work program for some people who we know we've identified who have disabilities and other kinds of challenges that make it difficult for them to make that transition. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be working with them to try to get them to work, but we should do it in a way that makes more sense given the challenges that they have and that they're facing. And I think this helps us start to make that kind of a sort. So it's taking, I think, something of an opportunity with what the federal government has given us, which in and of itself is not a great opportunity.
Representative Leffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner. I understand budget neutral at the state level. We're shifting from one pool to another, and it doesn't affect the state budget, but I heard you say you're adding two quality assurance people just to make sure that the counties deal with all these new requirements, you know, well, so we don't get sanctioned. And is it budget neutral to the counties? Is there additional funding for the additional staff requirements? Obligations that will be upon the counties expected to assist us in achieving performance standards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the only additional funding to counties on this page is for the development of the specialized job programs that I talked about at the beginning of this page. There is, I believe, about $1 million in the first year and $1.65 million in the second year and in the base for those services. No, there isn't an additional chunk of money going to the counties to deal with some of the additional complexity that's coming. Counties' services are funded through a consolidated fund, which is about $111 million a year, which we allocate out to counties, and that's where they're going to have to look to figure out how to meet these additional challenges. They have flexibility in how they use those dollars, but obviously they have a lot of pressures on them as well.
Representative Leffler.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't hear you say that that $111 million was being increased and counties have to deal with inflation, and you're saying there's additional responsibility. So I think your answer, if I'm interpreting it, is there's no additional money available for county administration, even though there'll be an expectation of changed responsibilities and perhaps increased responsibilities. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is exactly what I said.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to follow up on that, I'm wondering, do you have a measure, and I'm not sure if this is helpful for anybody but me, but do you have a measure that's FTEs per client served or per family served? I'm trying to get a sense of efficiency within the department and how that's working.
Mr. Representative, because we don't deliver services directly to the people, we could do that. I'm not sure what it would exactly tell you. It would probably be more meaningful at the county level, where they're administering the benefits and the eligibility and the work services, what kind of ratios they have. And I can tell you that that is pretty widely variable from one county to the next, as is a lot of what we do. But with, for a job counselor who's working, you know, with the employment pieces of this, I think you'll usually find a case within the range of 100 or so families that they're working with, more or less depending on the county and the kind of case that they're carrying.
Representative Avery, just the last question, because we have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, just a comment. I just wanted to point out for the questions that I have and that I've observed here, I think this is a very creative way to solve a problem. I just want to remind members, these are the hardest to serve people. And I bet you the county staff know these people really well. And so they can design a program that will meet these unique needs. And I think it's nice to see some innovation coming from the department about this.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, do you want to move on to the next page?
You know, we're going to stop here in about a minute, so why don't we just hold off on that, and it looks like we'll see you again tomorrow.
Okay.
So with that, I think I'll adjourn the meeting.